91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. According to our guest today, over the last 25 years, no religion has become the fastest growing religion in the United States. Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Although our country is still very much identified as one nation under God, the truth is the number of non-religious Americans is precipitously rising. And around the world, millions of people have turned away from traditional faiths and embraced the secular life. Sociology and Secular Studies professor Phil Zuckerman is the author of Living the Secular Life, New Answers to Old Questions. Can one still live a good and moral life without God or religion? We'll learn more in moments on Topical Currents after the news.
Seven minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman is a little under the weather today. Is there a human impulse for religious guidance and perhaps an afterlife? Religion gives people hope, direction, and comfort. It promotes morality, honesty, and charity. Well, this hour we visit with Pitzer College Sociology and Secular Studies Professor Phil Zuckerman. He's written the book, The Secular Life, New Answers to Old Questions. And he joins us from Aspen, Colorado. That must be nice. Welcome to you, Mr. Zuckerman.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Atheism, skepticism, humanism, concerning religiosity, how much have those viewpoints grown, say, in the last 20 or 30 years?
It's been an explosion. It's been a real burgeoning. I guess, you know, these things mean different things to different people, so we're never exactly sure. But when people were asked back in the 50s and 60s what religion they were, less than 5% chose none, N-O-N-E, saying they had no religion. And that kind of crept up to around 8% in 1990. And then suddenly, in 2001, it hit jumped up to 14%. That made headline news. It was CNN, et cetera, et cetera. And each year since, it's crept up and up and up, 15%, 16%. Now we're somewhere, low end would be around 20%, according to the Pew. High end would be around 30%, according to the Wynn Gallup poll. So somewhere between 20 and 30% of Americans are now saying they are non-religious. They do not identify with a religion. So we've never seen anything like that in the country's history.
You're not really comfortable with the word atheism. Explain that, and also, is there a label for what you believe?
You know, it depends kind of if I've had my coffee, depends where I'm at, if I'm at the in-laws' house, if I'm at a debate on campus, if I'm trapped in an airplane. It kind of depends on the social context and who I'm talking to. There was a time in my life where I was very, very comfortable with the word atheist and very proud of it. And to me, it signified a kind of confidence in my position and a real willingness to say I don't believe these things. I think they are problematic. I may have said silly at an earlier time in my life. I may have said dangerous at a certain time in my life. And so there was a time when I was a sort of staunch atheist. And if asked, am I an atheist today, I will most certainly say yes. But as I've gotten older and had more and more of these conversations, I guess what's happened to me is, you know, if someone asks me what I am, that's a chance for me to talk about who I am and what I am and what I believe. And so to say, well, I'm an atheist, that's a little bit problematic now because, number one, it's just a term of negation. It's saying what I don't believe in. It's also putting theism, God, at the center, and then sort of declining that. And as Sam Harris and others have said, I don't walk around saying I'm a unicornist or, you know, I'm an astrologist or something. I don't. So it privileges theism as sort of mainstream, and now I have to assert what I'm not in reference to it. So it's also, you know, it's ultimately quite negative. It's saying what you're not, what you don't believe, and it can sometimes, again, this goes back to the context, it can signal to certain people that you're angry or that you're hostile or that you have a problem with their religion. And it just, sometimes I do have a problem with religion, but most of the time I don't. And so I would rather say what I do believe or what I am. And I do like secular humanist a lot. I mean, in fact, I think it's perfect, but a lot of people don't really know what that term means. You know, humanism is just sort of the belief in the potential of good of humans and the ability for humans to do, to solve problems and make the world a better place. And that's kind of where I hang my hopes. And secular just means non-religious. But I guess I wrote a chapter in my new book called Aweism, A-W-E, and it's funny because some people are loving it, some people are hating it. One reviewer said it was an awful term, and then I got a call from another reporter saying, oh, that was my favorite chapter, I love it, it's just what I was waiting for. So I was just trying to capture a sense, I personally feel a lot of awe in my life, or maybe not even a lot, but throughout my life I feel a deep sort of gratitude about life, a sort of existential joy and wonder. Awe at the mystery of being and being alive, and that's really, if someone asked me what I am, I'd say, well, I'm someone who feels a deep love of life, a deep love of being alive. I don't know why we're here. I don't know what it all means. I'm often just sort of dumbstruck by it, but so I would like a term that would sort of capture that, which I just don't think is captured in atheism.
So you're using the word awe in its true intent, meaning, you know, very profound rather than the sweater you saw at the mall.
Yeah,
awesome.
I don't mean sort of dumbstruck, and I don't mean, yeah, something you saw at a nice shop somewhere. But yeah, that kind of deep. Many mystics have talked about it. A lot of religious philosophers have talked about it. Rudolf Otto wrote a book about it in sort of the numinous he talked about. But I guess for me, it's just that feeling that you get sometimes. Sometimes it can be from, you know, deep, profound moments. Sometimes it can just be from being in nature. Sometimes it's just picking your kids up from school. But a sort of feeling of simultaneously feeling old and young at the same time, feeling huge and infinitesimally small at the same time, feeling tremendous significance while also feeling the tremendous insignificance of things. I don't know. I'm not a poet, and I get a little, as a sociologist, this area is really where I start to feel a little nervous getting going there. But I guess I wanted to write something that says, you know, we talk about religion as though that's the realm of these feelings. And, oh, if you're secular, you must never feel wonder. You must never feel the profundity of being. You must never feel profound existential angst or profound existential joy or bliss or gratitude. And that's simply not so. I've been studying secular culture for quite some time, and that's not just a religious thing. You find many secular people also have these experiences. They just talk about them a little bit differently. They don't draw any conclusions from them the way religious people do. They just experience them, and it gives depth to their lives. And I wanted my fellow Americans, I guess, to know that to be secular does not mean you sort of live a cold, black and white existence, but that it's a rich and colorful and very profound existence just as well.
Well, you used the term secular humanist. What does that mean precisely?
Yeah, I like that one a lot. So I guess it's two words that have been joined together. So secular just simply means non-religious. And, you know, in a nutshell, it means to be secular means to not hold religious or supernatural beliefs. It means not to participate in religious rituals or rites or behaviors, and it means not to affiliate or belong with a religious group or denomination. We call it the three B's, belief, behavior, and belonging. And if you don't believe and you don't do any religious behaviors and you don't belong, you're effectively secular. Of course, to be secular is different in different cultures. What it means to be secular in India is going to be different than what it means to be secular in Japan or Vermont or Alabama. But in a sense, it just means non-religious. But humanism is a more affirming position. It's saying, I actually believe in humanity. I believe it's capable of horrendous things, but it's capable of wonderful, altruistic, good things too. And if you look at the accomplishments of history and the progress we've made, you chalk it up to humans. So you don't put your faith in any gods or gurus to solve the world's problems. You put your faith in your fellow men and women and other humans to be loving, to be rational, to be reasonable, and to be creative, and to make the world a better place. So I guess you join those together. I'm a non-religious person who puts his faith in humanity, secular humanist.
And you also teach it. Tell me more about Pitzer College in California, and also your Department of Secular Studies. I think that's unique in university life.
It is. Thanks for asking. I appreciate that. So Pitzer's a small liberal arts college. We're not so known, not so well known east of the Rockies, but west of the Rockies, our reputation's growing. We're one of what's known as the Claremont Colleges, which is a consortium of five undergraduate colleges, Pomona College, Claremont McKenna, Scripps, Harvey Mudd, and Pitzer being the newest. It was founded in the 60s with a real idealistic spirit and a real progressive ethos, and it prides itself on an emphasis on social responsibility, community engagement, and also being creative in how it approaches academic life. So it's a really great place to be a professor because you get to teach whatever you want, however you want, and there's a very sort of experimental and supportive environment. And I was always studying religion. I always taught religion. I studied religion in grad school. That was what you studied. There was no way to study atheism, humanism, secularism, other than if you were lucky enough to do a section on that in a religion class. But I was teaching classes on religion, but noticing this, you know, rise of the non-religious and seeing that, man, the world's becoming way more secular in most places, not everywhere, but we're seeing this huge growth of secular men and women. So I started instead of teaching a class called the Sociology of Religion, I wanted to teach a class called the Sociology of Secularity. You know, who is secular in terms of demographics, race, class, gender, sexuality? How do secular people live their lives? How are they involved in politics? How are they involved in nationalism? You know, all the things we've always done with religion, I wanted to do that for the non-religious. And it turned out that I had several other colleagues who were also interested in these questions. One was studying the Soviet Union and looking at kind of state despotic enforced atheism and what the havoc that wrecked. And then others were looking at the sort of debates over creationism in school, intelligent design, Darwin. And he taught a class called Monkey Business, sort of debates over evolution. I had a philosopher colleague who was studying skeptical voices within Islam. I had, you know, so we were all sort of started to teach these new classes in a sort of disparate fashion. And I thought, hey, there's something here. And most importantly, I saw the student interest. So when I started offering a class on skepticism and secularism, the class was overflowing. And all these students said, wow, you know, I'm a major in religious studies, but this is what's really interesting to me. I don't want to study church history. I don't want to study the Bible. I want to understand these issues of secularism. And they were so excited. And I thought, there's something here. And I started going to conferences and meeting other colleagues in other parts of the country and the world who were having similar a change in focus. You know, hey, no, we've been studying religion for 100 years. No one's been studying the secular. So I got my colleagues together. We had a little retreat. We sort of talked about the classes we already offer. We talked about some classes we might potentially want to offer soon. And in the end, we saw, hey, we could offer a major here. We've got enough classes where students could get a really thorough interdisciplinary education on secular culture, secular thought, secular philosophy, history, politics, etc. So we proposed it. It was approved by this committee, then that committee, and eventually it was approved as a special field group, they call it at Pitzer. We don't even have departments, actually. We have field groups. And so it's the first program in secular studies, and we've had our first major graduated a year ago, and we have another one that's set to graduate this coming May.
Okay. We're speaking with Phil Zuckerman. He's the author of the book, The Secular Life, New Answers to Old Questions. Time for a short break. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with Sociology and Secular Studies Professor Phil Zuckerman. Phil, some suggest that humans are born with a religious gene or such. So there's been belief in the divine back to prehistoric times. Why?
Yeah, that's one of those claims that always irked me. Even before I was studying secular studies, it just as a sociologist, we are almost trained to be very suspicious of any kind of claim that humans have a natural predisposition for any kind of belief. We strongly believe in sociology that most of our beliefs we get through socialization and internalization from the people that raise us and teach us about the world in conscious and unconscious ways. So we're always a little skeptical of that, and so that's kind of where I'm coming from. But the notion that humans kind of naturally or have always have this predilection to believe in the divine, I guess I would have two criticisms of that. So number one, we just have I say three. Number one, we have ancient voices of disbelief and skepticism going back thousands of years. In fact, all the way to ancient India, the Charvaka, a Lokayata, were a group of philosophers who doubted all theological claims. They said, this is all there is, there's nothing more, there's no afterlife, there's no karma, there are no gods, it's just the natural world. And that's going back to 2,500 years. You have skeptical voices in ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient China. So there's always been, ever since we have writing, people doubting. So that's number one. Now, it's possible they're just a tiny, tiny minority, but they've always existed. Number two, we know that there are huge segments of the world today that are secular, that are just non-believers. In fact, there's some societies right now, Czech Republic, Estonia, where the vast majority of people do not believe and are not, they don't believe in anything divine. So Scandinavia, huge chunks of Canada, Australia. I mean, we just have so many societies where there are tens of millions of people with living without any beliefs in the supernatural or divine. So, you know, clearly they're not unnatural. Clearly there's not something wrong with them genetically. And I guess the third thing I would say is that it is true that in every culture throughout history for which we have evidence, there seems to be some type of religion. That is true. Well, in every society we have evidence for, there's also some form of dance or some form of crime. But we know that not everybody is interested in dancing and not everybody's a criminal. So just because we find evidence of religion in every culture does not mean every member of that culture is religious to the same degree. Just like not everybody, you know, some people love dancing. It's their whole life. It's their whole world. Some cultures are, characterized by a love of dance. And there's always some people that don't like dancing, don't feel natural dancing. It just doesn't speak to them. And not everybody's a criminal, and yet we have evidence of crime in every society, too. So what I would say is, yes, it does seem, if we take, you know, history in the, you know, on the world, it does seem that most humans, most of the time, have had some predilection or to believe in the divine. But not everybody, not all the time, and the numbers are growing in the more secularizing trend right now.
Perhaps our listeners would like to get involved on the program. It's easy enough. Phone 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email is open, radio@WLRN.org. That's radio@WLRN.org. Phil Zuckerman, many people have rejected so-called organized religion, but they still maintain some form of spirituality. Your thoughts on that?
You're absolutely true, and this just kind of cuts to the complexity of the what's going on here, the complexity of the human condition on these matters. I've interviewed many people in my work who, yes, they don't want to identify with a particular religion, either for political reasons or theological reasons, or it's just not for them. They don't want to say, you know, I'm a member of this, you know, I'm a member of the Lutheran Church, or I'm a member of this or that. They actually don't even feel comfortable congregating with others. They have no interest in standing in pews, sitting up, sitting down, crossing themselves, shaking this person's hand. And yet they live their lives with a deep openness to what they would call something more. Perhaps it's a universal spirit of love. Perhaps it's a universal life force. And it very much informs their daily lives and how they understand their place in the universe. And so they're not big on dogma. They're not big on Ten Commandments, but they are very big on finding meaning in a sort of non-empirical spiritual vibe or energy or force. And I guess for me, I just never quite know where to place these people. Are they secular? Are they religious? Are they in some in-between zone? And I guess where I fall down is, in terms of belonging, they're clearly secular because they don't belong. In terms of practices, they're probably secular because they're not doing a lot of the traditional rituals and rites. They're not doing baptisms and whatnot. But in terms of the belief category, if they believe in something supernatural, something transcendent, something beyond the natural world, then they are blending into the more religious zone. They're not totally religious. They're calling themselves spiritual, but they're certainly not absolutely secular on that front, because a secular person will deny anything beyond the natural physical world.
Again, we're speaking with Professor Phil Zuckerman about his book, The Secular Life, here on Topical Currents. And again, the phone number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Tell me, Phil Zuckerman, What if people are do not believe in God, and then they have children, and they probably have in-laws and parents who think, well, this child has to have some religious training right away and starting early. How do you handle that?
I'm in the belly of the beast right now as we speak. I'm at my in-laws' house. It's Christmas laden. There's the Christmas tree. There's crosses. There's Bibles. And I got my three kids. They're older now. They're not as young anymore, but certainly experienced that firsthand. I was raised Jewish, at least culturally Jewish. None of my parents or even grandparents were believers. So I was raised with Jewish culture, Jewish heritage. But my wife's mother became a born-again Christian, 25 years ago or so. So she and her husband are strong Christians. And so when we had our kids, this was very serious for them. They wanted their grandchildren baptized, and they wanted their grandchildren to be believers and to not go to hell, as it were. And we struggled a lot. And in the end, actually, I'd say we didn't struggle too much because my wife and I were dead set against on teaching our children that there's a ever-watchful God who's reading their minds and will punish them if they do bad things. We were dead set against on teaching the children that this God killed his own son so that that son's blood would somehow wash my children of sins. I mean, there's a lot of theology in both Judaism and Christianity that I strongly object to and actually find detrimental to children's well-being. So we did not raise our children with any religious beliefs, and we made that very clear to my in-laws. And they, I think, maybe had a harder time with it than we did. I think they were scared and worried and concerned, but we tried to be gracious, we tried to be polite, but we were firm. We were very clear, and we tried to explain why we don't believe these things and why we don't want our children, and we would hope that they would see what wonderful, loving children they are, and they have. And I'd say, now 20 years into it, the peace has reigned. We sort of gracefully respect their religiosity. If they want to say grace around dinner, it's their home, that's what we do. We don't put them down, we don't mock them, we don't deride them, we try to accept them and love them, and they seem to have, come around the same way. They see that we're raising our kids in a secular home, and they love their grandchildren, and their grandchildren are doing quite well in life, and I think there's been kind of a mutual learning and respecting that you can have these differences, but you're still family.
Phil Zuckerman, you've written a previous book about this subject, but what makes people turn away from religion? Is it logic? Is it the death of a loved one, perhaps illness? Looking at genocide and famine and all of the woes of the world that say there couldn't be a God?
All of the above. I interviewed person after person after person who was religious and then gave it up, walked away, and I wanted to understand why. And for every single individual that I interviewed, there were 3 to 4 answers per individual. So often some idiosyncrasies there, idiosyncratic reasons where people had very, you never heard that reason before. One of the more dramatics was a young man who was a strong Christian and decided to raise some money for a local children's hospital. He felt that his Christian faith compelled him to do such a charitable act. He raised $30,000 for this children's hospital, and the children's hospital was so touched they invited him for a dinner to honor him and thank him for this. Well, he had never actually set foot in the children's hospital. He goes for this dinner, his parents are invited, members of the community, and they honor him, and he takes a tour of the hospital. Within a week, he was an atheist. He said, to see the pain and suffering of those children in that children's hospital destroyed my faith. So you have sort of stories like that, but when I sort of piled all the accounts together, certain things did rise to the surface. And yes, suffering, tragedy in life, having an untimely death of a loved one could cause people to question and doubt their faith. Straight up, like you said, the cognitive logic, a lot of people said it just didn't make sense. In fact, that came up more often than not. They wanted to believe. It just, they couldn't, their minds couldn't get around certain illogical or unempirical statements. I had people talk about the influence of education on their faith, that they took classes, often, interestingly enough, religious studies classes, which caused them to doubt, question. I had people talk about the internet actually fostering their atheism, where they started to read things they didn't know were out there, criticisms, critiques, histories of other religions, which caused their doubts to fester. I actually had people also talk about when they had one parent that wasn't all that into it, sometimes had a sort of a socializing effect. It's like mom wanted to go to church, dad, you could always tell, wasn't too into it. Sometimes he'd bow out and work in the garage, And there was just this sense that, you know, or dad, you know, or dad wanted to go, but mom converted just to make dad happy, but you could always tell she wasn't too into it. And this kind of plants a seed in a lot of kids' minds. There's no question that if your parents are not religious, the likelihood of children being religious is extremely small. One study put it at 5%, in fact, that if only 5% of kids raised in secular homes ever become religious. And that goes back to what we talked about earlier about, you know, is it natural or is it something learned? And if you look at the statistics on parental influence, you will quickly see that religiosity is most of the time something children are taught, not something they come to on their own.
I suppose there are those who sort of play it safe. They don't go to organized religious services or pray every day, but they admit that there's something out there, and at least they keep the window open for afterlife.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I spent a couple years living in Denmark doing some research and just enjoying life there, and I would say I called them somethingers or something believers. That was, in fact, the most common response I got. They're not, you know, convinced atheists. They're not strong believers in God or Jesus, but they would look at me and say, I think there's something out there. There's something more between heaven and earth than we know. And it was kind of a passive, quiet belief. It didn't really dictate much in their lives, but there was definitely that sense that there's something more. And I understand that. I guess I sometimes feel that too. It's hard for me to articulate, but that's as far as I'll go. I don't, you know, go any further. But yeah, I think it's, and in terms of the afterlife, you know, interestingly there, we do have some data. More and more Americans say they don't believe. I think it's now 25% of Americans say they don't believe in life after death, that's pretty amazing. One in four just sort of accepting the end of accepting their own mortality. But I think these are questions that will always be there. What is there something more? What happens when we die? I don't think we'll ever have definitive answers, and everybody's, I think, always going to wonder, and there will always be people who think, I think there's something more.
Let's take a telephone call or two, Phil Zuckerman. This is Henry. He's in Boca Raton. Hi there.
Yes, good afternoon. My question is this. Isn't it ironic that your program today and your guest is talking about non-religion when the world is being threatened by extreme religion, extreme Islam, ISIS, people who believe so vehemently and so strongly that it's threatening, it's creating this threat to our very existence.
Well, and we could go back historically to the Crusades. You know, there have been a lot of wars over religion.
That's
correct, Professor?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess my response would be, you know, I'm not one of these people that blames religion for everything. There have been many secular regimes that have done all kinds of horrible things, from Pol Pot to Stalin. So it's not that religion has a monopoly on genocide or terrorism. But there have been times throughout history where it was religion-based. And I think right now, in 2014-15, we are in another situation where it does seem to be that religious extremism, in this case mostly Islamic, although not always, that is seems to be the most dangerous and kind of terrifying manifestation of that right now. It's deeply, deeply troubling and upsetting, and something we should all be really talking about and trying to understand and trying to deconstruct.
Phil Zuckerman, we're going to take a short break on Topical Currents. We'll be back. And it is Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman's Under the Weather this afternoon. And we're speaking with Professor Phil Zuckerman. He's a professor of sociology and secular studies at Pitzer College in California. Phil Zuckerman, tell us about the case that you relate in the book out of Rhode Island, the case of Jessica Ahlquist and the litigation which ensued.
Yeah, okay. Well, Jessica was quite a heroine in my book, quite a brave young woman, brave American. She was going to a public high school in Rhode Island, tax-subsidized, and in the auditorium was a giant Christian banner hanging from the wall that talked about being thankful to God and you know, and those in that kind of language right there in the public high school. And she would go to assemblies or performances or various, you know, things taking place in the auditorium and look up at this confessional banner that was talking about God and maybe Jesus. I can't remember if Jesus was included. And she thought, this is not, I'm not in church here. I'm at my high school. This is not the place to be told, to be taught religion. That's, people are free to do that in their homes or in their churches or synagogues, but not in my public school. And she's absolutely right. The First Amendment is very clear. The first clause of the First Amendment talks about government not being able to establish religion. That comes before freedom of speech, in fact. So clearly our founding fathers thought very, took that very seriously. So she issued a complaint. She said, I want that banner taken down. It's not appropriate. It's not constitutional. And, of course, the school refused and said, oh, it's been there for years, blah-bitty-blah. It's part of our culture, our school's culture, and what's the problem? And we all love God. And so she had to take it to court. And I believe it was ACLU in this case that came to her aid. And it went to court. And while this, in the immediate wake of this, she experienced extreme harassment, not only on Facebook and Twitter and in the internet, but phone calls, in the mail, in her face. She was called every kind of name. She was threatened. The threats got to such a pitch that the police had to escort her from class to class. Whenever she was on campus, she had to have a police escort. Finally, the courts agreed with her. It was a clear and obvious case. The court didn't even go very far. Just the courts there in Rhode Island agreed that it was a violation of the First Amendment, so the banner was taken down. The morning of that ruling, her own assemblyman, her own representative in Congress, went on the radio and called her an evil little thing. So, you know, she survived. She, not only did she survive, actually, here's something interesting. Had this happened 20 years ago, she'd have really been left alone in a lurch. But now, because the internet, organized secular groups came to her aid and raised money for her and so that she could go to college, just sort of as a way to support her and show their appreciation for what she was doing by taking a stand as a 16-year-old girl in Rhode Island. And she was given tens of thousands of dollars to pursue her education. I'm very proud of that, actually. I think it's a great, great thing that the secular community did for Jessica. But her case is just one among so many where if people do speak out and say, hey, this is not okay, they often face a serious, serious backlash.
And back to our callers. This is Don in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Don, thanks for your patience.
Sure, no problem. Good afternoon. You know, at the end of the day, I find that you know, religion, whether you choose a religion or not to believe, is a very personal choice. But I have a question. You talked about the interviews and discussions you had with people and why they left religion. Conversely, I also know of a couple different individuals that had a devastating thing happen in their life. They lost loved ones, children, through auto accidents and things of that sort. And their faith actually grew stronger. So I'd like to know if you've had discussions with people that have also gone through that as well, and I'd like to take that off the air.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I hope I didn't give the impression that, you know, the untimely death of a loved one causes everybody to lose their faith. It's just one possible factor. And I think you're absolutely right. In fact, there seems to be a bifurcation. When people experience pain or suffering in their lives or the death of a loved one, usually that increases their faith or actually causes them to turn to faith. The grief is so acute, the pain is so acute, that actually religion is the only, it provides tremendous comfort. And yet there seems to be maybe even just a minority of people who it causes them to question and doubt and lose their faith. And I'll just give you a quick, you know, in other words, there seems to be both patterns at play, absolutely. I mean, after all, if the untimely death of a loved one caused people to lose their faith, there'd be no religion anymore. So obviously it's not the sort of death knell to religion. But in my interviews, it seemed to come up time and time again. Often a parent dying of cancer early caused people to just say, you know, something's wrong here. A loving God wouldn't do this. But again, that's not for everybody. And I would just affirm that you're correct. For many people, such experiences cause them to find faith or strengthen their faith. But it's the same thing with war. You'll find people, you know, the saying, there's no atheists in foxholes. There's no question that suddenly when you're being shot at, you'll start praying to everything. And yet I've interviewed many, many veterans who actually lost their faith during war, not gained it.
Yeah, talk more about that. You had the case of of Scott Renfro, who went to Iraq.
Yeah, this was another, it's actually a pseudonym because I didn't want a lot of these people to experience what Jessica Ahlquist experienced. But Scott was yet one of the many people I interviewed who went off to Iraq, a Bible-believing Baptist. He was from the South, from the Bible Belt. Dad was a sheriff. Mom was a school librarian. Very involved in Christian life, youth groups, etc. Was so happy to bring his Bible with him to Iraq, was involved in prayer groups and Christian groups. And just the carnage was just unrelenting. And finally one day, he was running, they were running supplies on some road back and forth, and one of the other units got hit, and like 10 people were killed one day, and it was the sort of same road that they always travel. And the preacher, the evangelical minister, the military chaplain came in and said, you know, that's too bad about what happened, but, you know, you guys are, you know, God's watching you, so you have nothing to worry about. And he just stopped and said, well, wait a minute, man, my buddies were just killed in an explosion yesterday. Why wasn't God watching them? And he just felt that the chaplain couldn't give him any adequate answer. So he went and started Facebooking with his youth minister back home, and same thing. And within months, he had totally lost his faith and thought, there's no God that is watching over us, and there's no God that would condone what we're doing or allow what's happening to us or others. And he came home an atheist and started up a secularist group at his Texas campus.
Why is secularism considered to be un-American by many? And do you ever see the time when someone who professes a disbelief in God could be elected president?
Gosh, there's a lot of lot there. I'll try to be succinct. I think if I can just go to the heart of the matter, I would blame the Cold War on this very much. When we had the Soviet Revolution, it was decidedly and overtly atheistic. The leaders of the Soviet regime were atheistic. They sought to destroy religion. They closed and burned churches. They arrested and killed priests. I mean, they were rabidly anti-religion, those Soviets. And so in the Cold War, we had this situation. Here was a regime that was anti-democracy and also anti-religion and anti-God. And so what that meant was we must be God's country. We in the United States were the defenders of freedom. We're the defenders of liberty. We're the defenders of democracy, unlike those communists who are also godless. This is exactly when we change "In God We Trust" suddenly becomes our national motto and gets put on our money. There was no "In God We Trust" on our money before the Cold War. It is when we insert "One Nation Under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. There was no "Under God" in the original Pledge of Allegiance. A lot of Americans don't realize this. It was in the 1950s that "In God We Trust" got put in our money, "Under God" got inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance, and this was a time where then Americanism and God became fused as one in reaction to those godless communists. And what I'm finding, as the memory of the communist regime in the Soviet Union starts to fade collectively from Americans' consciousness, as younger generations who don't even know what the Iron Curtain means, that linkage of, you know, godless communism and God-full Americanism is starting to wane. But the day that an atheist president would be elected is still a long, long way off. I'll just end with several national polls when people were asked, would you be willing to vote for a person who was a woman, Mormon, Jewish, Baptist, Catholic, Hispanic, Latino, African American, Asian American? You had a whole laundry list. Atheists came in last place of what people, homosexuals did better. So there is really still a very strong anti-atheist sentiment in America. And I cited the Cold War as one factor. Obviously, there's others, but for sake of time, I don't want to drone on and on too much.
Well, speaking of time, it's time for a short break on our program. We'll be right back. And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Professor Phil Zuckerman. He's written the book, The Secular Life, New Answers to Old Questions. And we'll go back to the phones. Let's take Mark in Miami. Mark, you're up.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Yes, it's Mark from Miami. I love the topic. Love the topic. Okay, I want to...
Hello?
Yeah, I'm on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I want to say it on this note, religion, ethologies. I'm going to say we all created equal. And second of all, I think it's like a 50-50 thing. You chose religion or ethologies like as a passion, like a person want to major, elective or subject in college. Why I say that? Because I think God gave all man 50-50 equal choices. Like it was talking about the topic, and God we trust was put on a dollar bill. Okay. When we have an idea come to our head, is it religious or is it ethology? Maybe it could be both. But I think it is very unique for people as human beings to choose their own way of being and choice. The fact is, people that don't believe in religious, maybe they have to grow into it. It's something like college, an elective. They have to study it. They have to get a vibe for it. If you don't have a vibe for something, you won't be able to achieve and master that something and that goal into whatever you believe in, whether it's a profession or it's a religion. Okay, when people, it's two things I want to note on, prayer and politics. Let's say prayer in school and Pledge of Allegiance. Some people might not believe in Pledge of Allegiance. Some people might not believe in prayer. But sometimes people, if it's, you know, in Congress or the state or our United States, we put both together. Sometimes it might confuse people. And, you know, we as humans, we have to make a choice into what we truly believe in, what is right, wrong, what is belief and not belief. Some people say, well, we have all these planets in the world. What's the purpose of all those planets? Is the planet being lived on by aliens or humans or whatever? What's the purpose? Everything have a purpose, but
Mark, could you just kind of boil down what you're saying in a sentence or two so I can get a better idea of what you mean?
Okay, I understand that. And what the guy was saying about being God we trust, okay, about the currency. And go ahead. I'm gonna listen again. Go ahead and I kind of lost my other input on it, but go ahead.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. I'll pass that on to you, Professor.
Oh man, I liked when he was going off on the planets. That was getting fun. I don't know where to respond. There was a lot he said. I guess the two things I would respond to was one is choice. I would agree. We have choices in our lives. I find that religion, however, limits our choices because religion, most religions, Islam, Christianity primarily, do not say, hey, you can choose to believe in me or not. They say, yeah, you can choose, but if you choose wrong, you're in big trouble. That's not really a choice. You know, someone says to me, hey, Phil, do you want a chicken sandwich or a tuna sandwich? It's your choice. But if you pick the tuna, I'm going to shoot you. That's not really a choice. And I find that religion usually says you actually don't have a choice on who you want to marry. You have to marry someone within the faith. If you don't, there's going to be consequences. You don't have a choice to worship this God or not, because if you don't worship this God, there's going to be serious consequences. So I actually find that choice is far more embraced in the secular community and in secular culture, choosing how you want to live, choosing what you want to believe, whereas in religion, it's more like our way or the highway. There really isn't that much choice.
Tell me about what would happen if the mystery of creation was ever solved?
Wow, man, that's a freaky concept. I don't think it ever will be. I think we live in eternal mystery, and that's the condition we're in. I don't think we'll ever know why we're here, why there's something instead of nothing, how it all began, what was before the Big Bang, why was there something to be banged at all? I mean, I just think these are deep. But I will go with that and say, you know, if in so many years from now we actually can finally understand creation, I don't even know what that would mean. It sounds glorious. If not, it might just be a bad joke. I don't know what would be there. It's hard for me to fathom.
I'm the host. I'm objective here.
Okay.
Why do some religions seem that it's so important of them to spread their ideas to others, to expand it?
Yeah.
While others seem to be content to just say, well, I believe this, and you can believe what you want, and I don't care.
It's so true. You can really classify religion on whether they proselytize or not. Obviously, Judaism does not proselytize. Hinduism does not proselytize. And then Islam and Christianity are the great proselytizers. I often wonder that as well. Like, what is the deal? Now, I know that Christians will say, well, they're trying to save people. It's an act of goodness. It's an act of goodwill. I mean, if I knew that this medicine would cure your cancer, wouldn't I want to give you this medicine and try every way I could? I might even sneak it in there. So I think for strongly believing Christians, true believers, and strongly believing Muslims, they're trying to save people from burning in hell. They think they're being good and noble by trying to force others into their religion. But I think that's one of the major turnoffs of traditional religion, is it seems to tell people that they know what's right for you, they know what's truth and you don't, and they know that they have deep answers to the most important questions, and Mormonism's big on this as well, and I also find it a turnoff. But you're right, something's going on there psychologically, social psychologically, why people feel the need to get others to believe as they do. And I guess I'm no psychologist, but as an armchair psychologist, I almost want to say insecurity, right? If you're more insecure in your beliefs, you need to get others to believe it too, so you can feel more confident in it. Whereas when you're very confident in your beliefs, you don't waste too much time trying to convince others. If they don't understand, you're not. They're accepting it does not affect your sense of well-being. But I find with the strongly religious, doubters actually create a lot of existential insecurity for them.
Is it common for people who've been raised as children and really had religion being a big part of their life and very strictly enforced, you can't do this, you can't do that, you're going to go to hell, to once they get to be adults to sort of rebel against that and want to disassociate from organized religions?
Well, it's now becoming more common than ever. It hasn't been for much of human history. For most of human history, it worked. People replicated the religion of their parents, and they in turn threatened their children and used the same techniques. But now, in the last 100 years, for the first time, we're seeing widespread secularization. So, and you're absolutely right that when the golden window, if people are going to leave religion, or in fact accept it, I should note, is that between 15 and 25. It seems to be when people get away from their parents for the first time, when they get away from their home for the first time, when they go off to college and they go start working on their own, this is the time in people's lives where they tend to reject religion if they're going to. It is a large part of more and more. In fact, right now, 20-something, so people between 18 and 29, that generation, 33% now in America say they have no religion. That is the highest rate of secularity we've ever seen in our country's history, and it's at that young generation there. So there is something there about getting away from mom and dad that increases the likelihood of rejecting religion. It obviously is not going to do it completely, but it is definitely a factor.
We're speaking with Professor Phil Zuckerman. He's a professor of sociology and secular studies at Pitzer College in California. Describe your early years. I understand. I know you're Jewish, but you said your parents were also non-believers. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. I grew up in a very secular home in a very secular neighborhood in a very secular part of Los Angeles. So my both sets of grandparents were non-believers, but of different stripes. My mom's parents were just more interested in skiing than God. They were just nature lovers, and I don't think they ever said the word atheist. They were interested in music and Bach and Mozart and ballet and nature, and they just were sort of non-religious. My father's parents were hardcore socialists. They were Bundists. They were Yiddish speakers and actually were very ideologically opposed to religion. In fact, when I grew up, kind of most Jewish kids went through the ritual of bar mitzvah, so I did too at a Reconstructionist synagogue. And I remember my grandma, the Bundist, was like, kind of, why would you do that? Why would you set foot in a synagogue? So I had benign. Yeah.
We have to run pretty soon.
Okay, yeah. So I was raised in a non-believing home. We did some holidays. We went to synagogue now and then as a community thing, but I was raised without any beliefs at all on the supernatural.
Well, thank you very much for coming on our program, Phil Zuckerman, and his book is The Secular Life. Thanks, Phil.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for tuning in. Thanks to our many callers. Our program is produced by Richard Ive, technical direction by Paul Leary. Perhaps a friend would like to listen to today's program. One can find free audio downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. Also, see us at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program deals with an issue which isn't all that important, but it could be for youngsters. What about the myth of Santa Claus? Should you conform and pretend those gifts came from the North Pole, shipped by reindeers? We'll have some fun with that one. Also, a return visit by retired attorney Paul Lipton. He's the author of The Hour of the Wolf. Joseph Cooper, thanks for listening. Here and Now next from NPR News.